Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and it's my pleasure to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026, brought to you during Long COVID Awareness Week. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, I can't help but imagine a world where the brotherhood of man / woman is celebrated globally, and for our listeners, a world without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, clinical services, and cures. Now, that's something not only worth imagining, but in my view, actively visualising and then achieving or making happen. This year, as in past years, I have the pleasure to interview clinicians, researchers and health professionals from all over the world whose critical work impacts those with ME/CFS, long COVID and infection-associated chronic illnesses. One such person is our next guest, Kit McMahon, CEO of WISE, which stands for Women's Health in the Southeast here in Victoria. Kit has 20 plus years experience across education, training and not-for-profits, where she consistently and passionately advocates for gender equality, empowering women and girls, and in this context is developing a keen interest in energy-limiting conditions given the high incidence of women living with these debilitating conditions and the significant impact on women's health in general. Along with her work at WISE, Kit is Deputy Chair and a Director of Volunteering Australia, as well as Director for Tradeswomen Australia. She holds a degree from Monash University, postgraduate qualifications from the University of Tasmania, and an MBA from Macquarie University. Welcome to the Emerge Australia podcast series, Kit McMahon.
Thank you very much, Anne. I just need to let you know that I have stepped down from that role at Volunteering Australia, most sadly. It was a great organisation and it still is, but thank you so much for recognising that too, because it was a great board to be part of.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Yes, well, you've got a very full life. You're a very busy lady, and I understand that sometimes some things need to drop off so that you can focus on those things that are your priorities. So I totally get that. So, Kit, your background is in advocating for gender equality and women's empowerment. It's such an impressive background. How does this passion that you've got, and without the passion you couldn't do the work that you do, so how does that passion intersect with your growing interest in energy-limiting conditions, particularly in the context of long COVID?
Well, thanks, Anne, and thanks for the opportunity to be part of this conversation and support the great work that you're doing and your team. Look, I think for WISE and the women's health movement, at the core of what we do is trying to address the barriers to equity in health and social systems so that women can truly realise equality, be emancipated. And that's not, when we say women, that's all women, regardless of the, you know, different discriminations and oppressions and compounding barriers that they face. And what we know is that if you're a woman in our health system in Australia, there is a reality to your experience that you'll face that more likely than not, you'll not be believed. More likely than not, the pain that you carry, the symptoms you carry will not be believed, and the conditions that you face will be dismissed. And that's really been very much forefronted in the last 2 years, or 12 months, 2 years, with some of the government work in Victoria and federally that's been going on. So for us, we know that there is a gender lens to health and wellbeing, and that is certainly the case, particularly in the conditions that we're talking about today. You know, that there is evidence of the prevalence of, in this case, long COVID, but, you know, there is also a consistent pattern across Australian analysis, as I understand it, that long COVID presents more significantly in women. And because of that, we know from global studies and local studies that because of that, there will be extra burdens or extra realities that women need to navigate because health is gendered. Now, I say that because there are things in men's health that are gendered as well. Mental health and men's well-being is an experience that has a gendered lens to it. But similarly with women, their pain and the disease that they carry, we know that that's a gendered experience. They might get, you know, if they've got a care load because of their work and their caregiving and their reproductive health, there is a load there that they carry. But more systemically than that, the reality of being a woman and the research required to actually understand the impact of that on the presentation, the prevalence of the disease and the treatment and diagnosis of it is one we've got to constantly argue for. It wasn't that long ago, as we know, and that women were not included in research, in medical research, because they were considered atypical. The man's body was the typical one. Yeah. So that's the reason that we've got an interest in it, because until those systems and structures and policies are changed to make an equitable environment, women will disproportionately suffer through diseases like long COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. And of course, one of the challenges with long COVID, as in many other diseases that women suffer in particular, it's invisible. And so like ME/CFS, you know, this is a disease where particularly you see, you know, women will just soldier on because that's what they do. What people don't see is the crashes that they have behind the scenes and complete inability to do the things that they would normally do. So what do you see as some of the unique challenges that are faced by women with a range of energy-limiting disease? And what are your thoughts on how we can raise awareness to ensure that their voices are heard?
Well, I think the first thing we're going to tackle is that there are some conditions that are considered normal for women. Tiredness is normal for women, yet with long COVID, fatigue is a persistent functioning limiting tiredness, and it's considered, oh, you just don't work with your children, or you're just running, or you're working too hard, right? You know, breathlessness, if you're a woman who perhaps, like normal many women, myself included, carry perhaps a little bit more weight, you know, breathlessness might be considered or discriminated against or not listened to if you're carrying a bit more weight because, oh, well, you're a bit overweight, you're not fit. So that might be something that sort of impairs the ability for our world to recognise that you've got a disease. And then there's the height of, you know, what they call cognitive impairment. Now, there is a thing that a lot of women in my world are facing at the moment, and certainly the women in that we work with in the region, which is menopause. And menopause, oh, it's brain fog. Or even if you've got a baby, you've got brain fog. So a lot of these characteristics of long COVID are seen as part and parcel of what it means to be a woman. So don't whinge, you know, just get on with it, take a Panadol. When we did consultations for the recent Victorian Government's Women's Pain Forum, I was very close to calling our submission, just take a Panadol, because the amount of times that women had been told that, whether they had come in with a mental, you know, pain that they carried because of grief, pain they carried because of family violence, pain they carried because they had an undiagnosed broken vertebra, pain they carried because of post-birth complications, the amount of times that that had been told to them. So I think that's the first thing, you know, and that we've got to do is recognise that some of the stereotypes that we attribute to women because of the life, what it means to be a woman, and that stereotype might not be the stereotype. It might actually be because that woman is carrying an illness that affects her energy levels. We also have got to understand that, you know, it's not a woman's problem. Right? So sometimes I think, what can we do to raise awareness? I don't think women need to have their awareness raised. I think the awareness raising and the work needs to go on into the medical system, the health system.
Yeah,
of course. Now, I'm not going to sit here and bag out the health system. I'm from a family of medicos. They are all overworked. Our health dollar is stretched, right? It is the assumptions that we have around what constitutes the resourcing of these social systems that needs to change. So that's where I think the awareness goes. You know, who, you know, when we do feminist analysis and we understand how systems are structured, one of the first things we do is saying, who's got the power to decide?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who is making the decisions about where things have got to be put? Who is making the decisions about what agendas are being set, right? That's where the attention needs to be paid. And more we see that changing as well, which is really good.
So you'd be happy, as most of us are, about the significant allocation that was put into place by the federal government into women's health. The work Jed Carney and Tanya Plibersek are doing on, you know, domestic violence in women and the hidden.
Huge.
Yeah.
And can I tell you, Anna, I watched, because I'm a nerd, I watched the federal parliament when Jed Carney got up there and said, in the hallowed halls of the green room downstairs, the lower house, the words menopause and flooding and period in this place that had never heard those words before. Separate. Now, that is a moment, right? We need to recognise that. And I am absolutely of the view that the change that we're seeing now because of investments in women's health and well-being, the focus on family violence and its prevention, would not have occurred if more women were not in power.
Yes. Right?
It is because we have greater diversity in our leadership, because we have people who more represent the country, that we are getting these matters seen to and funded and addressed. Now, it's not huge. We can always do more, right? But, and absolutely, I would not take anything away from those leaders in our federal government and indeed in our state governments who are doing their level best to address the scales, as it were.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I was speaking to Jed Carney at a meeting that she and I both attended last year.
Yeah.
Where I was talking about her new portfolio, and we were talking about those people that are hidden in her portfolio, like maybe women with energy limiting diseases, ME/CFS, long COVID, where there may be domestic violence in those families, but they're not the ones that are usually focused on. They're not the major focal point of some of the work that is happening. How can we raise the profile of this invisible group of people within the focus areas that the women's health movement, certainly federally, is now working very hard in? What are your thoughts and recommendations?
The first thing you've got to do is you've actually got to change the decision-making processes, not so that they compromise clinical evidence or anything like that, but so that they centre lived experience. And when I talk about centering lived experience, I mean not as a committee on the side, but people who are very much going to be the end users of this process. Now, in family violence, we are getting a lot better. We've still got a lot of work to do to centre victim survivors' voices in the design of procedures and policies associated with responding to and preventing violence. So I think that's the first thing you've got to do. you've got to center that lived experience. And if you're going to do that, you've got to recognize that that takes resources and effort. And you've got to do it well. You know, every time someone tells a personal story, it costs them, right? You would have this with your lived experience advocates. Every time they come out and tell their story to share it, they're not there to entertain. They're not there to make you feel better about yourself. They're there to communicate a message, and it costs them in one way or another. It's exhausting. So we've got to support them, and we've got to remunerate them as well, right? We've got to have the right systems and support in place. I think the other thing that we've got to do as well in terms of addressing the silent ones is we've got to actually recognize that the people in the room are not normal. The people in the room that make the decisions are not normal. So I say this, for instance, when I go in and speak about skills policy or workforce development policy, which I do a bit, sit around a table with a lot of people that look like me, educated, gainfully employed, mortgaged, got insurance, safe kids. I'm not normal, right? The world is not like me, right?
Yeah.
In fact, the majority of the world have compounding forms of discrimination and oppression that they face. So we've really got to make sure that we're making decisions that don't reinforce what a norm is. And the other thing that I'd say to you is that we can only see what our data lets us see. And at the moment, our data reports in cohorts and silos. The truth is that the prevalence of family violence in our community means that there are people who have long COVID, who have, you know, the diseases and the illnesses that you represent, who are experiencing family violence in all its forms, right? So we actually need to set up systems and set up policy that actually is set up on what we call intersectional premises, so that we're trying to provide support and services to people who are facing compounding forms of barriers in their life, not because they're bad people or because of them, but because of the systems around them. And I think those are the things that you've got to do. And I will just say, finally, we've got to get the way we collect data better. So the amount of times I go into data collection holdings of government and see male, female, and other, and I can't, you know, how do we make sure we've got people whose experience is First Nation with disability? We're never going to know who is suffering unless we see the world in our data like it really is. So those would be the things that I think are crucial to actually achieving better outcomes for the people that we serve.
I think that, you know, you raise a really important point, question about data, and it's certainly something that doesn't get lost on us at Emerge Australia, given that data on people with long COVID, let alone ME/CFS, has until very recently not been collected. So when we look at where we sit on the continuum of other chronic and complex conditions, you know, being able to talk about incidence and prevalence and being able to then subdivide that into gender and various age brackets within that is just an impossibility. So when you then go to try to develop policy, you can't say it's evidence-based because we don't have the data.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with you. We are moving the needle slowly on that one with the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, and are hopeful that we will be part of the next Australian Burden of Disease study that the Institute produces, which has been probably 3 or 4 years in the making right now.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's the other thing, isn't it? The world does not move quickly when you're trying to create change, does it?
No, not quickly enough, I think. And, you know, if we go back to that comment that you said, Anne, about young people, I think one of the barriers that I believe that health policy doesn't engage with enough is the compounding reality of youth and socioeconomic or access to resources, right? And we know that young people are struggling to get housing, be safe in this world. You know, we talk about how good the unemployment rate is. Have you looked at the youth unemployment rate?
Yeah.
And if you're a young person with long COVID or any other disease, and you can't afford the treatment, let alone the access to see someone who could recommend treatment, it doesn't matter how much economic analysis you do on that or whatever, that person's life course trajectory is not only about their trajectory, but about the generations that come afterwards. And I think the biggest burden on our health system is that we don't engage with the reality of intergenerational, the impacts of social determinants of health intergenerationally, right? You know, we can provide all amounts of resources and support into, you know, some of these like bridges and buildings and hard structures and, you know, defense and everything like that. But the intersectional compounding reverberations that will occur across time if we don't support someone's well-being and those psychosocial impacts that happen because of their well-being is not being taken care of, it's enormous, and we live with it, and we know we do for decades. So that's one of my great sadnesses, is that you know, where are those conversations occurring in policy? We have an intergenerational report. I know that it's very economically based. Well, how are those social determinants, if they're not impacted, how do they cavitate and impact over the longer term as well? You know, if women have the care burden and yet they suffer the burden of disease that we know that we're suffering, particularly long COVID, what does that mean as well in our world? So they're very big questions, probably for a late afternoon on a weekday, but yeah, I think they're kind of where we need to be putting our effort if we're really going to make the change. But as you said, that stuff doesn't occur quickly because we're actually trying to change years of ways of thinking.
Yes.
On the world. So that, and unfortunately that takes time because people don't think like you or I do, Anne. And that's a problem, isn't it? They need to think.
Absolutely.
The world would be so much better.
Totally agree. Why would I disagree with that? But yeah, I love your talking about social determinants of health and intergenerational impacts, because when you're talking about young people, and we do have coming up the Young Person's Day or week, I think it's coming up in the middle of Long COVID Awareness Week, whilst we don't have data on the number of young people with long COVID or ME/CFS, of course we don't, we do know that what happens to these young people is that they miss out on school, they might have to drop out of tertiary education, they are socially isolated because they cannot interact with their peer group other than maybe, if they're lucky, on social media or, you know, via devices. And their world becomes so isolated and so closed in that, of course, they lose hope. And the very trajectory, and I should probably talk more about ME/CFS right now than long COVID, but long COVID is right in there because some people have long COVID for a very long time. But those people, ME/CFS, may end up, if they're really severe, you know, completely missing out on life because their existence has been confined to their home or their bedroom. And when that happens and you start saying, well, what happens to the next generation? Well, it actually doesn't happen because if they don't get a cure or if they're not diagnosed properly or, you know, in a timely fashion, they just get sicker and sicker and sicker. And the whole thing around social determinants of health, let alone Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you go, my goodness, you know, we've had parents say to us when they've had their young teenage children who become, you know, young adults, saying they're going to need to house them somewhere because parents are getting older. So what happens if something happens to the parents and no one's there to care for the young people? you know, where do they go? So that's number one on Maslow's hierarchy. You need a roof over your head. Then you need someone to care for you. Yeah. So what you're saying is, you know, spot on in that broader policy context that addresses the social determinants of health, which we don't talk about enough in infection-associated chronic illnesses.
Like, you can kind of understand why that intersectional or intra-sectional approach doesn't occur, because our health system is built on the idea of, yeah, well, there's your heart medicine, you know, your brain medicine, and yet, you know. So in getting the collaborative approach happens, but it takes a long time to get there. But things like housing, transport, those fundamental things, as you talk about the hierarchy means, I mean, even when I do work in prevention of family violence, housing is the number one recovery mechanism for a family, and it's often women leaving the family home still to recovery and back to work and back to well-being and getting the kids in school. If there's no housing, the wheels fall off. That's why housing is such an important thing. When we do community sexual reproductive health and we talk about, you know, access to information, well, if the information is not available in my language, you know, you've just set up a discriminatory barrier right there. So, look, I think the solution is actually not working in silos, but working across the social determinant spectrum and the prevention response and clinical continuum working together. If we go back to COVID, you know, everyone still talks about what happened in Victoria and COVID, but there's actually lots of really good stories of the sector activating really quickly at place-based level. And what happened is we almost had a situation, a dissipative construct. We had to do something, right? And you had the hospital networks and the community networks that just came together locally so quickly around the table, in a way that was more proactive than the centralized agencies. And the feeding of the information about who was what and what do we need where was a lesson on what is possible when you need it to do. And hopefully some of that is maintained. But even if we go back to sort of the illnesses that we're talking about today, can't we get the clinical and the mental health and the community engagement working together? You know, like there's lots of good stuff that can be happened when those things come to. How do we get primary care screening working well with rehabilitation for that, you know, continuum of care? So there's lots of opportunities to get that pathway working well.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. It is about, one of my biggest things has always been integration and coordination of care. And it's about the systems working together. And certainly at the clinical level, we don't always see that. You know, at the clinical level, it's often left to the person with the condition to coordinate everything.
Absolutely.
Because the systems are not speaking to each other.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're not. I mean, that's not an unusual thing in places like Australia. We often have situations where the accountability or the compliance burden is shifted to the individual rather than the system. So you have this situation, you know, like in medicine, you become, well, you know, a bunch of women very expert in menopause, how to manage their menopause, you know, as well. You know, in education and training, you have people who have to manage their own education pathway. So I think that sort of thing about that burden in health on the managing of it, as much as we want to talk about the continuum of care and care plans, it still comes back to the individual to diagnose the system, to work out where they've got to go, to navigate their way through a whole complexity way of understanding the research, let alone the mischief making and the myths that come out about it, right? To find a place. And that's why organisations like Emerge are very important, because if you know you can just go straight there, you know, and that will be the book of truth, as it were. That navigation will be there. But, yeah, I agree with you. That burden that's placed on patients, particularly patients who are not like me. I mean, I'm highly efficient in understanding the medical system. I can speak up for myself when I go to a doctor. I don't see it as a power over me relationship, but I'm not usual.
No, not usual. And that's what our patients tell us. You know, a lot of our patients feel very disempowered when they speak to their health professional. And, you know, we know that a lot of older patients, you know, still consider their GP as sort of some godlike figure. And if the doctor says this, well, my doctor said it, so I've got to do it. But, you know, the challenges of people with long COVID and ME/CFS go well beyond that. Mm. Look, our patients can't even get to the doctor.
Yes.
Because they don't have the energy or the capacity to leave their home and go to a doctor's visit. So then, you know, all sorts of other things come into
everything's compounded, isn't it? Again, about this assumed norm. What's the average patient? Someone can get in the car and drive to an appointment.
Yes. So it is about recognizing patients who don't fit into the assumed norm. I love your use of that word.
Well, there's a term that's often used in the gender world, and you can, you know, Google it. It's called reference man. And every sort of system has a reference man. It, you know, and it's changing. It's the basis that policies and procedures and services are based on an assumed norm. And there's a few great books out about it, particularly with regard to women's health. And once you understand that, you can see it everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Reference man is everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to change tack a little bit because you are a person who's very, very well versed and experienced in training and education. Mm. And for women struggling with the impact of long COVID, particularly those who maybe are coming out the other end, but they want to re-engage in the workforce. Mm. What are your, you know, what's your advice? You know, what should employers do for this group? Because this is something we at Emerge Australia are very interested in, and that is educating employers about reintroducing people who've been off for a long time back into the workforce, because that's not only, you know, beneficial for the person, but it's beneficial for the employer and it's very beneficial for Australia's economy. What are your thoughts?
So important. I do have a lot of empathy for it because I sort of wade deeply in this area. Well, the advice that I give to people who are returning to work after a long illness or a long time away from the workforce is get yourself a network and align yourself with a crack of TAFE, right? And in our world, at the moment, my colleagues in private RTOs will be horrified to hear me say that, but our public TAFE system now has more opportunities for people who want to get credentialed to go into them. And what a TAFE offers, the public institution offers, is support mechanisms. So you've got like free TAFE in Victoria and elsewhere, but they also have all the TAFEs that I know in Victoria. They've got really great student support systems, but they're really good teams, right? And they're there to help. So that's the first thing. I do not know a person that runs a TAFE school or a TAFE department that doesn't have the best interests of their students at heart. So I think that's a really important thing to do. And the reason I say that is because there are ways that those public institutions can provide support and nurturing to go back into the workforce. I can't fix it, unfortunately, but they can help. The other thing that you might consider doing is going and seeing if an apprenticeship's available. But the truth is, if you're recovering from a chronic illness, apprenticeships are not made for you, unfortunately, in this day and age. Mm-hmm. They're still not made for you. So I think that sort of journey is. And when it comes to employer settings, look, honestly, I think on the basis of all the evidence I read, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
We're still making arguments for having diverse women's voices on boards. I think the idea of having women on boards has sort of got a bit of traction. There's a few that are accountant, but it's being interpreted as white women.
Yeah, that's right. So
you know that, right? Yeah, and it's not being interpreted as women with a lived experience of disability or First Nations women. Well, the government boards are doing it, but not many else. So I still think we've got a long way to go. But if we are organisations that are talking about social determinants, recovery, as well as clinical response and prevention, that has to be a part of our mandate. You want to measure productivity,
yes,
but you don't want to measure this part of the community.
No.
Your productivity scores are out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think being, you know, for our organisations, being clear about how health has that economic impact, how a good health, a thriving health system that is respondent and proactive to the needs of all its community in all its forms is better for a healthier economy, a better Australia, is has to be part of our mandate.
Yeah.
I didn't answer that the way you wanted to, I'm sorry.
Oh, I wasn't expecting. I had no expectations of what you would say. The reality is, of course, that it's not just women struggling, men, but it's also our young people struggling to get back to school. And, you know, so we do have, unfortunately, a lot of young people between the ages of 12 and 20 who miss out on a lot of schooling. And it's very, very challenging for those people to, A, get back and continue their education to which they are entitled as a right, and B, then support their mental health to not get completely discouraged about, well, life's not worth it. And we have many examples where we hear a very, very poor mental health amongst people with long COVID and ME/CFS because these people have lost everything. And, you know, trying to make your way back into a meaningful life for each individual is a huge challenge.
Yep. And I think, you know, part of our, well, I don't think part of our remit is advocacy, is for that, isn't it? If I go back to the people that you're representing in all of their forms, our role is to have a voice for those people that have those challenges, isn't it, Anne?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got two more questions.
Yes.
The first question is, tell us a bit about WISE.
Oh! How long have you got? Women's Health Service has been around in Victoria, Anne, for about 40 years, and they started their life in the factories of, you know, Western Melbourne and Northern Melbourne, helping migrant women workers in those factories understand their health and wellbeing needs and their right. And then over time, they also were very much involved in stopping what was called domestic violence, you know, giving voice to it. And they're also involved very much at the start of the movement in Victoria for legalising abortion. And then over time, they've evolved and grown. But probably in the 80s, there was a movement of the then government in Victoria to create what was called a women's health policy. And really the structures of the women's health movement emerged out of that. So Women's Health in the Southeast was founded. We operate across 10 local government areas, Cadinia Shire down to Mornington Peninsula and into Port Phillip Council. There's 9 regional women's health services and 3 statewides in Victoria, and we all tend to do the same things but in place-based settings. So we prevent gendered violence, we improve sexual reproductive health, we improve mental well-being, we address the barriers to intersectional gender equity, and we also do work to support women whose health is being affected by climate change and disaster.
Wow.
So those are the sort of the things that we do. But because we're place-based, we tend to sort of, they all sort of, those pillars kind of merge together. So, for instance, you know, I've got colleagues that are out at the moment delivering capacity building and support to parents in high schools to talk about consent. Now, that will not only be about improving sexual reproductive health. Of course, that's about preventing gender-based violence in all its forms. It's about creating intergenerational connectivity, building conversations that support equity as well, empowering as well. But similarly, I've got, when we work with migrant refugee women, some of those women who come to our country, their primary experience of government is the government trying to kill them. So, you know, our conversation with them might be the first time that they've had the opportunity to talk about a period, but also we're sort of saying, well, this is how you talk to our health system. Well, the government health system has not been a healthy thing for them. So you're brokering that as well. And then, you know, we're working at the moment to set up an International Women's Day event with a local agency called Kara House. We're building a resource kit for that. You know, our team are working with community around how do we support to have gender-based violence conversations through men and boys. But at the same time, you know, partnering with organisations like yourself to build the capacity of our health system around applying a gendered lens to the work that they do. So there's all sorts of different things. I mean, feminist primary prevention health promotion agency. That's probably the tenets that we...
Fantastic. Can I ask, is there a WISE in other states of Australia or are you...
Yeah, good question. So the structure that Victoria has is a little bit unique, but there are women's health services in other states. So Tasmania has one. There's a few in New South Wales.
I'm not sure what's happening in Queensland at the moment. Someone might like to let us know.
But, for instance, the ACHOs, Aboriginal Community Organisations, that they are a very powerful service for their people as well. I mean, in some way, shape or form, each state has these grassroots community place-based organisations around changing social norms and working with community. So
it just strikes me as, and, you know, my background is really working with different disease state organisations as CEO, but ones where you have a national framework and therefore can deliver at the grassroots level overlaid by, you know, national policy framework.
Yeah. I mean, certainly in Victoria, we translate as an activator of policy. So, you know, the government has just released the Women's Pain Inquiry. We're having conversations with the government. Well, how do you translate that into practice? You know, in some of the parts of Victoria, there's been the release of the breast cancer bus.
Yep.
Or, you know, how does that happen? The Victorian government's got a policy around self-administered cervical screening, delivery capacity building to women and community on how to do that. So we are absolutely an activator
What you deliver sounds amazing. And
it's a far cleverer team than me that does it.
But your organisation does under your leadership, and it does sound amazing, and it's an absolute education to me. And I know that we at Emerge Australia are really looking forward to being able to work with you and co-design a project that will address not only our cohort of patients, but women who are served by your organisation. So it's a very exciting time for us. My last question to you is about what message of hope would you like to share with our listeners during October Venus Week to inspire and support those affected by this debilitating disease? And do you have a message for our Health Minister, the Honourable Mark Butler?
Yeah, I think there's two things I'd say. Firstly, to the people that are listening to your podcast, it's often very tempting when you listen to people like me to hear the bad stories. And I have been often accused as being a bit of a rose-coloured glasses when I say this, but it's true. The norm, the average person in the world, is actually someone that wants to do good. And I think sometimes in this world we're often convinced that actually there's more of the nastiness in the world and the people than there actually is. So I think that's the first thing to say. I'm quite hopeful about community. When you work closely with community, quite hopeful of them. I think my message for the minister, and firstly, I'm the last person that's going to say that I could do a better job, but because I don't know how you could be a politician, but anyway, I wonder what support and how we can strengthen the advice and the lived experience that our ministers hear when it comes to the design of legislation and policy for community. And, you know, when I walk through Parliament House, it's a very beautiful place, but it feels sometimes as if it's a bit of a bubble. So that would be my question, I guess. What support or advice can we procure for, or can we source for our you know, godlike creatures in government to have that centered, that lived experience in the design of the legislation and policies that they go through. And that's not only for the minister, isn't it? It's for the department as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And very valid. But I'll add to that, just say that certainly in my experience in the last 5 years, let's say, in my recent experience, the position of people with lived experience has been a far greater focus than it's ever been before. And what we need to do is focus on co-design, and we need to make sure that it truly is person-centered care legislation policy right throughout the health system, not in just some quarters, but right across, in order to ensure that we are actually delivering the right services to the right people at the right time for the right reason.
Yeah. And that takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Because our systems weren't developed on that.
No, that's right. Let alone our Commonwealth state system, which is fraught with all sorts of challenges.
Yeah.
Look, it's been an absolute delight speaking with you, Kit.
Oh, thanks, Anne.
Thank you so much for your time. As I said, I really look forward to working closer with you on a couple of initiatives that are yet to be developed that we might be able to co-design together. But on behalf of our listeners, thank you for giving us this wonderful...
Oh, no, thank you, Anne, and thanks to Emerge as well for the opportunity.
That's amazing. So today's podcast is part of a clinical series and a series of discussions with people in community like Kit McMahon, which we are recording. And Kit is certainly one of the people of influence that we were really interested in talking to. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia, particularly during 2026 Long COVID Awareness Week. We invite you to tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget that for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. And Kit, thank you very much again, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.